Subway everyday value means many mouth-watering piled high favorites are $5 footlongs, like the fresh-toasted tempting meatball marinara. And made-to-your-order BLT, the $5 footlong anthem rolls on only at Subway, where great everyday value lives. Subway, eat fresh. The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Dare I say my favorite BS Report ever. We're having somebody on who changed my life, who changed the lives of really every Red Sox fan and made it better. And how many times can you say that about somebody? 2004 postseason hero for the Boston Red Sox, recently retired, and now is on the BS Report, Mr. Dave Roberts.
Hey, Bill, how you doing?
Well, allow me to be the 1,477,383rd Red Sox fan. Thank you. Thank you for everything.
You're welcome, and that's something that you never get tired of, and I pretty much hear it every day. And, you know, to hear it one more time, it always brings a smile to my face.
Is it every day? I mean, literally every day does somebody say something to you?
No, during the baseball season, it's literally every day, and I live in a small town, beach town in San Diego, so with that said, it's spread out a little bit more, but, you know, around the ballpark, even walking around, it happens very frequently.
Well, what's interesting is, you know, you were in the league for, it looks like 10 years, right? 1999 to 2008.
Yeah, 10 years. Yes.
And you were on a lot of different good teams and you did some good things. And yet this one moment kind of historically has put you in this place with like this pantheon of guys. It's this iconic moment.
Yeah. It's amazing. And I think that, and it works the other way. And it's ironic that in that same city in Boston where Bill Buckner had a great career, but then for that one moment, you know, in the 86 against the Mets in the World Series, you know, ball goes to his legs, and that's all people talked about for so many years. And obviously they've kind of, you know, the city, they've made amends and he came back and everything's great now. But for me to be remembered, you know, after my career for that one great moment, you know, it's very humbling, you know, and I think that that's a great honor.
Well, one of the things I remember when you joined the team, because you had been playing pretty much almost every day for the Dodgers, and you'd been a big part of the 2003 team and the Red Sox. I'm going to use we when I talk about the Red Sox because I just can't help it.
Absolutely.
So we traded for you, and I was excited, and, you know, my dad was excited just because it was the type of player that we never had. This guy who could potentially play any outfield position, could come in at any point in the game and potentially swipe a bag for us, but you know, you're sitting on the bench most of the time, so you have to adjust your role. And I think what's interesting about that 2004 game, ninth inning, we're down by a run, we have to score. You're sitting there on the bench, and you're knowing that if something happens, you're going in. You're going from just sitting on the bench to all of a sudden being the key figure in this game, and then Millar gets the walk, and you're in the game. So walk us through the mindset.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that that's a great, you know, I love talking about that. And I think that that started not only, you know, that day in October, you know, it started in September once I knew what my role for that team was going to be. You know, I came in a trade and I was playing pretty much every day because Troy Dixon was hurt. I was playing right field and a little bit of left field. Manny would come out of a game and I'd fill in left field and things like that. But come September when Trot Nixon came back healthy, I was a bench player at that point in time. And so there was a game in Yankee Stadium on a Friday where I came into pinch run and Mariano Rivera was pitching. We were down a run at the top of the ninth inning. And I get on base, Jorge Posada goes to the mound and has a meeting with them. And then their defense, after I realized this afterward, was to hold the ball. So they were going to hold the ball. They held the ball, and then he went to the plate. I ultimately ended up stealing the base after a couple pitches to home, and we ended up winning that game. So I put that in my memory bank.
Yeah.
And So once the, the playoffs came around, I did a lot of studying on video, whether it be the Angel relievers, and potentially the Yankees, so I kind of studied tendencies and film and things like that, as well as kind of working on my jumps and my leads with Lynn Jones during batting practice to kind of keep my legs under me.
But when eight innings go by, you're in the dugout. How do you stay loose knowing that you might come in this big spot?
Especially, in the situation, and the way that the status of the clubhouse was at that point in time, the dugouts were small, which they still are, but the clubhouse was smaller than it is now. And then the tunnel area, which has been revamped, you couldn't do anything. So basically I kind of, beginning part of the game, I'm watching film and, middle parts of the game, I'm in the clubhouse, jumping up and down, trying to get my legs loose. And then come the sixth, seventh inning, I have to go into the dugout to kind of watch the game and get a kind of feel for the game. I knew my situation, so I was kind of mentally preparing.
So almost like a baseball closer. I mean, like knowing that you're coming in the ninth inning, maybe.
No, that's exactly right, because come the eighth and ninth inning, if the game was on the line, Terry Francona said, regardless of who gets on base, you're going to pinch run, and you've got to, make something happen. So obviously in that situation, you're down a run, and I see the situation, the at-bat developing with Kevin Millar, and he has a great at-bat, and
right.
finds a way to work a walk against, arguably one of the greatest closers of all time. And, so once he got the walk, I kind of looked down at the end of the dugout and I tell this story, and Terry Francona gave me a wink, and it was kind of like, go out there and go get him, kid, and make something happen. And so as I go out there, I got so many nerves. I've got adrenaline. I've got fear. I've got excitement. Oh, I got anxiety, all these different things, bottled up inside my body. And I get out there and Lynn Jones says, okay, we're going to bunt here. There's a bunt sign from Dale Stem, third base coach at the time, and I'm like, no, there's no bunt sign. I'm going to steal this base.
Nice.
Yeah, and he's like, this is exactly what happened. And then, so then he's looking, he's signaling to Dale Stem to look into the dugout, and then they take the bunt sign off. Billy Miller's hitting. And, at that point in time, I hadn't played in a week and a half. I hadn't done anything in a week and a half, so I don't got my legs under me, but I've got the knowledge of Mariano Rivera and what the tendencies and what they might do to prevent me from stealing this base. So he picks over one time, the nerves start calming, he picks over again, then my legs feel good, I'm starting to get into the flow of the game, and then he picks over a third time. And I'm telling you, after that third time, it was like I had played the entire nine innings.
Nice.
My legs felt great. My focus was there. The nerves were all calm. And so then I knew after the third time I had that base dealer intuition that he was going to go to the plate here. But with that said, he was going to hold the ball. That's what I remembered from September. He was going to hold the ball. So wait him out. Just kind of relax your body, wait him out. And he held the ball, and it felt like an eternity. He held it. And, but then once he went to the plate, I had a great jump. And if he wouldn't have held the ball, picked over three times, I wouldn't have went the first time he went to home plate. But he held it. I got a great jump. And once I took off, I knew I had that base stolen.
So you had two advantages. You were in the situation against the exact pitcher and catcher before.
Yep.
And then when he tried to pick you off three times or whatever he's trying to do, that got you into the game. So almost he would have been better off just throwing in the plate the first time.
Absolutely, absolutely. Because it's just like when you're off, when I have a big lead like I had, and I'm diving back, exploding to the bag three different times, that gets my legs back.
Yeah.
But to get as loose as you can, you can't simulate the game situation, the game speed, if you're not loose. So then by doing it three different times, that kind of got that explosion, that quick burst, in my body.
Well, with all that said, they still, for a pitch and then a throw to second base, they actually did a nice job. Like
They did a great job. Brad Mills, our bench coach, and still the bench coach, said that was the quickest time from home to second he timed all year.
Yeah.
And, and it's funny that as a base dealer, I was running and I felt the tag and Joe West called me safe and I knew I was in there. But then it's funny as when I looked back at the videotape, it was bang, bang.
Yeah.
And, You know, and I make a joke about it all the time. It's like every time I keep watching it, it seems like it keeps getting closer and closer, and hopefully Joe West doesn't change his mind and call me out at some point in time.
So then Billy Miller hits the ball up the middle. You score. Loudest stadium you've ever heard that you've been in?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he went from one of the quietest stadiums I've ever heard, you know, after taking a beating the night before, and the situation and facing that, you know, an embarrassing, you know, 4-0 sweep to, you know, our nemesis.
Yeah.
To, you know, scoring the game tying run in a huge game that just uplifted and gave everyone, you know, a ray of hope.
Yeah. So, you know, I was at both games. I was at game 4 and game 5, which combined, I think, was the greatest sports experience I've ever had as a fan. Just the, you know, 26 innings. It almost like the two games blend together. Now that a few years have passed, I can't even remember what play happened in which game, just that I was having a heart attack basically for two straight nights. And when you come out of this and you're going back to Yankee Stadium, it's 3-2, but we have all the momentum. Still, we're going back to Yankee Stadium. Do you guys actually feel like something's going to happen? Or like, oh, man, we extended the series? Or did you really think you were going to win?
Well, you know what? Before I go to Yankee Stadium, a lot of people forget, because obviously I stole the base in Game 4, but they forget about Game 5. I came in that same situation against Flash Gordon.
You're right.
And he likes to be slower to the plate, so I went in there with the intention of stealing second base again. But he was slide stepping, and he was clearly, if you look back at the video, he was clearly out of his rhythm, you know, and he was trying to prevent me from stealing second base and to, you know, do the same thing what happened the night before.
Yeah.
And so he got behind to Trout Nixon. I ended up stealing second base on the 3-1 pitch, picked up the ball that he had a base hit up the middle right to center field. So in a situation where, you know, it would be first and second, I was fortunately enough able to go to third base. Veritek hits a fly ball. We tie the game up right there and win it later.
I completely failed as a podcast host that I didn't mention that. It's a bad job by me, because that was a big moment, because Flash Gordon, he'd actually been pitching well.
If we lose game 5, game 4 doesn't mean anything, really.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so then I came in there and he summoned me again in that same situation, albeit a different pitcher, but it's still the same result. I ended up tying the game and we ended up winning later on in that game.
Well, for ESPN, for our 30th anniversary, we're doing this project called 30 for 30, which is 30 documentaries about the 30 years. And I'm involved a little bit with deciding what the documentaries are and ideas for it, stuff like that. One of the things that we're going to do is a documentary just about those 4 games.
Wow.
Games 4, 5, 6, 7. Just because I don't think people realize now what unbelievable baseball games there were. And as you mentioned, like, not just game 4, but game 5, you're talking about, If maybe 12 plays had gone the other way, of those 12 plays, the Red Sox go home.
Oh, absolutely. Well, game 4, if Tony Clark's ball doesn't bounce over and is in a ground rule double and stays in the park, Jeter scores, and then they win the game.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, Poppy's seemed like it was a 20-pitch at bat, or he gets a base hit. You know, I mean, it's against, I think it was Esteban Loaiza maybe or something like that. I mean,
yeah.
There's so many things that happen in that just one thing changes, then, you know, we lose a game, you know, and it's incredible. But, you know,
I'll never. Oh, God.
No, I don't want this to be untold, is that, you know, my role is reserve. You get 24 other guys that have been doing so much to get our team in a position that we were in.
Yeah.
And it's just like, as far as I was so afraid to fail, but then I felt I had an opportunity to hold up my end of the deal. You know, you got so many superstars on that team and great guys and great teammates. This was my opportunity to kind of do my part. And so that's what kind of really gave me the go-ahead and gave me the confidence to go for it.
Yeah, and that was really the neat thing about those 4 games is I think all 25 guys did something.
Absolutely.
I'd have to go through it, but I really think like each guy, like even Wakefield comes in game 5, Veritek has to catch him.
Yep.
And, you know, that's a disaster in itself, because he had never caught Wakefield, and we're all sitting there having a heart attack every time there's anything close to the dirt, you know, and it was just all these different little moments. Then, you know, nobody remembers Derek Lowe pitching on 2 days rest, game 7, Yankee Stadium.
That's right.
It just gets thrown, you know, the average Red Sox fan, I understand, the average baseball fan, I don't think even realizes that he was pitching on 2 days rest that day. The shilling bloody sock thing obviously still gets played now, but
Sure.
So many moments throughout. When did you feel like the Yankees, you kind of had twisted the knife in them officially?
You know what, I think that it started with, you know, after, you know, the stolen base and after Billy Miller's hit and after we win that game.
Yeah.
I think that from that point, that it was all about us at that point. That gave us hope.
Yeah.
So, you know, and before that game, Kevin Millar's talking, and we're all talking about let's just win one game. So that was the start of it. It wasn't about the Yankees at that point in time. It was about us with the ability to win one game. So then we started getting a little confidence after that game. And I think after game two, I mean, after the second game we won, after game five.
Right.
So we win game five. And I think that point, it turned and the momentum shifted. Even though they were going back home, the pressure had changed because I thought that they felt that the confidence that we started to kind of develop.
Well, as a lifelong Red Sox fan, I could tell you that the whole fan base, and I wrote a whole book about this, the whole fan base was just so prepared for things to go wrong. And I'm sure you could sense that when you were there, that we almost needed like some sort of karmic miracle for things to turn. Something that was just so unprecedented and out of nowhere that you couldn't help but get swept up in it and think, I know this is the Red Sox, but something is happening here. And I feel like that, you know, game four and game five, the combination of those two games, for whatever reason, put us in that place. And I keep telling, you know, I hear from Cubs fans, and they're like, oh my God, are we ever going to do it? And I really think for them to win a World Series, something like that has to happen. It has to be almost miraculous. You know what I mean?
I agree. But even like when Mark Bellhorn hits the home run, you know, in past, they would have called that ball a double or a foul ball or whatever it was, but they got it right, you know. Yeah. And then when Bronson Arroyo was trying to tag Alex Rodriguez, they got the call right. When in years past, just something bad is going to happen and it's not going to go our way. But things happen and they started going our way.
What'd you do with the championship ring?
I have it in a safe at home. And you know, when I go back to Boston, I wear it. But I don't wear it too often. And when I go to speaking engagements and things like that, I might wear it. But, you know, it's in a special place.
Well, you came back for that, which I think, man, you know, I was there for that game, too. You came back for the celebration. And meant a lot to me and a lot of, you know, it just didn't feel right to not have every guy there. And I don't think every guy was there. I think almost every guy was there. A couple guys couldn't come back, but it was really nice that you came back. I don't understand why you don't just live in the Boston area. I mean, you're like Paul Revere. You should just have like a restaurant or a bar or a store or something where you just sit there.
I know. You know what? Let me tell you a story about this going back there. Now that you brought it up, I took so much heat for going back there from other people because I just signed with the San Diego Padres, but I was on the disabled list to start the season. So in my eyes, I can't help the Padres anyway, who were in Chicago. Let me go back and enjoy this moment from the previous year, which to me, it wasn't about the Boston Red Sox or being a baseball fan. This is about history, you know, 80 years of history that it's bigger than just, you know, the San Diego Padres or even just the Boston Red Sox. It's history. And so for me to be able to take part in that, you know what, I took a lot of heat and I turned on the TV that night and the commentators are going back and forth on should Dave Roberts have gone, should he not have gone. He's a Padre now, he's not a Red Sox. And I took offense to that because these are baseball fans as an analyst, but they didn't get the fact that it's bigger than us.
Yeah,
and
I got it.
You see, and you get it.
Yeah.
It's bigger than us. And I think that I've always tried to play the game, be a person, and realize that it's bigger than me and it's not about me, and then just get perspective on things. And then the people that do get it and embrace that moment, it's a beautiful thing.
Well, it wouldn't have been the same.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it wouldn't have been the same if you weren't there. I just think it would have been 2% not as good, you know. They didn't resign you after that year, partially because you wanted to play every day. Did
Epstein to this very day.
You did?
I thank him to this very day, honestly, because I'm in the prime of my career. It was a great moment. I love the city. I love the fan base. But you know what? I had to look to my future and my career, you know, and I think that being a fourth outfielder, I would have been a fourth outfielder the rest of my career and in a great city and a great team, a great organization. But I needed more at that time, really, and selfishly for my family and my professional well-being, I wanted more, you know, and for Theo Epstein to oblige and to make a trade, to facilitate a trade to San Diego, I cannot commend him anymore.
Okay, I feel better, because I've been bitter about it ever since that they traded you. I just would have made you stay, but to hear how badly you wanted to start every day, I guess we owed you. But it would have been nice to have you on that team, you know? I think you would have been a standing ovation every time you did anything.
You know what? It probably would have, but the thing is that in a day where economics is king in our sport, for them to kind of look past that, I just think the game honors you. And that's an ode that I kind of live by a lot. You know, whether you work hard, you practice hard, the game will honor you. And I think that the way that Theo Epstein, you know, handled that situation, my situation, and allow it not hindering my career and being selfish, and you know, when he could have, because I was a controlled player.
Yeah.
The game honored him, and it blessed him, you know, the next year with the World Series, another one. You know, I think that's the way you do things.
And you ended up having three really good seasons.
I had three really good years. I did. And it's like, and he didn't worry about the backlash. I did this, an individual move to let this guy kind of flourish, albeit I would love him back, but not worried about the backlash, which a lot of people do. So I tip my hat to him for letting me do that, tip my hat to Terry Francona for giving me the opportunity to steal second base and letting me do what I do, and Billy Miller, a former batting champion, for letting him do what he does. And he's not a sacrifice bunter. He's a hitter. You know, these things, I commend these guys. It's amazing.
So you were a part-timer last year, and you just retired last month.
Yeah, I did, because my knee, I've had knee problems the last couple of years, and it's just the Giants were going in a different direction, and we had talked, and I think it was a tough move for them to kind of release me, but it was good for them, and for me, you know, I don't need to take the cortisone shots anymore, and I can kind of, you know, move forward, and I'm transitioning into, you know, doing some broadcasting stuff like that.
That was my next question. So what do you see? Studio? Do you see doing games, like being the color guy? Where do you want to do?
You know what? I've done some stuff for Comcast for the Giants, and I've done some stuff, some pre and post with the Padres. And I'm doing some radio down here in San Diego. I'm going to do some stuff for Nesson. This summer I did a little bit when I went back there to throw the first pitch. I think I don't really know. I think that a color is appealing to me, but you know, just having the ability to be a part of the game in some capacity, and I think that, you know, bridging the gap from players to viewers or listeners is intriguing to me, you know, and I don't know if it's I want to go into being a special assistant for an organization or something like that. That's why this is such an early stage of where I'm at. I'm trying to feel things out.
Right. Well, whatever, you know, I'd love to have you in Boston. I just like seeing you. I like when you come on the TV. I'm like, hey, it's Dave Roberts.
But no, I'm gonna come back in the summer.
I do think economically it might be in your interest to move back to the New England area. But I, you know, at the same time, you'd be such a celebrity. Like you know, you'd almost be like Britney Spears level when you go out to like mall, restaurant, anything. Maybe you don't want that.
No, I know. You know, and I love that. And it's the cool thing is that there's very few places and parts of your life that you can look back and everything, you know, you reflect on is positive. But when I think of the city of Boston, the Boston Red Sox, you know, when I was there, it seemed like after that trade happened at the deadline, it seemed like we probably lost 7-8 games the entire time, you know, including the playoffs.
Right.
And, you know, the people, my daughter was born there. So there's so many positive things. So every time I do go back, it's special.
I got to ask you about Manny. You know, I'm the biggest Manny fan on the planet. I think I'm the last person who's mad that they traded him. I'm the last guy because Jason Bay has been crushing the ball this year. And I think even the diehard Manny fans have now moved on. I'm still like, it's
good,
pathetic.
Good.
But
that's okay. I like that.
You were on this team that had all these veteran guys and these big personable clubhouse guys that were able to keep him in check for the most part. And sure. I think part of the problem last year was that they didn't have a lot of those guys. How important is it to just coddle this guy on a day-to-day basis?
It is. And I think in a perfect world, you know, you have everybody self-motivated and everyone, you know, pulling on the same end of the rope. But, you know, when you get him in the lineup, you know, there's no one better. And I think that, it got ugly, but, you know, when I was there, and I've known Matt even when I was in Cleveland, you know, he's got a huge heart. He works, as hard, if not harder than anyone that I've played with. You know, from the going in the cage or working out at 8 o'clock in the morning, even on road trips, that a lot of people study and videotape that people just really don't understand.
Yeah.
But there was definitely a part of it. You know, you got to keep them happy. But I think the benefits, definitely, weigh out the negatives, you know. But I think that team that we were on, you know, you mentioned that there was a lot of veteran presence, and then there were a lot of strong personalities and dynamic personalities. And honestly, I think without that, we don't overcome that 3-0 deficit. It just kind of balanced out. And I talk about this, the pressures and the expectations from fans and media, you know, in Boston. And I think that kind of crazy, laid-back, idiot attitude that, you know, Kevin Millar, Johnny Damon coined was needed for that ball club.
I couldn't agree more. It was – they always had the type of players that were these guys that actually understood the history. And
yeah,
when things went wrong, you could – not only were the fans tense, but you could actually see some of the players tense. And I grew up with Carl Yastrzemski, who was, you know, the signature guy on the team when I was a kid, and was this chain-smoking guy from New England with the Boston accent. And he knew when things were going wrong, he, you know, in his head, historically, he knew what was going on, whereas you had somebody like Manny who could care less, you know, and maybe that's what we needed.
We're in the World Series in Game 1. Manny slides for a ball, misses it, butchers it, and he gets up, comes in dugout. We probably give up a couple runs that inning to St. Louis, and he goes, "Well, guys, I guess I'm not going to win the Gold Glove this year," you know? And it's just like, are you kidding me? You know, it's just like that intensity in that situation, and that's his whole demeanor. So that's just, it's amazing.
What's your favorite Manny story of all time that I wouldn't know?
Gosh,
if you had to tell one story that defined him.
Probably the one story that defined him is hitting a home run in Cleveland and picking up somebody else's bat. I think it might have been A&R Diaz's bat, his next at bat, and hitting another home run.
What?
With a different bat, yeah.
Accidentally, or he just wanted to see if he could do it?
Just picked it up. No, just picked it up and thought, oh, that feels good. I mean, he used a lot of different bats, and no one hits a home run, let alone just get a hit, and changes bats. But to do that, and use somebody else and do the same thing, it's just, yeah.
When you joined the Red Sox in 04, Ortiz was just kind of emerging as, you know, he'd always been the clubhouse leader, but he was really emerging as the clutch guy in that team. Have you ever played with anybody like him, other than him?
He's just, no. I mean, honestly, that year, I've never seen anyone more clutch than David, and just such a big kid, and just the life of the clubhouse, and
yeah.
It is phenomenal teammate. And the list goes on, to be honest with you.
Who are your top four favorite teammates ever?
Trevor Hoffman.
Really? Trevor Hoffman?
Oh, absolutely. You know, he's a guy that, you know, doesn't fraternize before games. He's a quiet in the clubhouse, but he's like E.F. Hutton. When he speaks, everyone listens. You know, he does his running at 2 o'clock in the afternoon when nobody's out there, and, you know, work, gets his work in. He's just a consummate professional.
Yeah.
You know, and doesn't care about the notoriety and the comparisons, you know, with Mariano Rivera. And he's just, there's just no ego.
Is Ortiz in that class for you?
Yeah, David's up there. You know, he's that, you know, whether you're, you know, a young player, veteran player, Latin player, American player, he just kind of brings everybody together. He's kind of like that glue. You know,
Who is the guy like that in Cleveland?
When I was in Cleveland, the guy that they had that was the guy was.
Maybe you didn't have one.
Sandy Alomar.
Oh.
Definitely Sandy Alomar.
How about the Giants the last 2 years?
The Giants the last 2 years, I think that I think it was me. You know, I mean, I was that guy. You know, you start working your way up the veteran ladder.
Right.
You know, and I think that it's funny to see myself when I first see Sandy Alomar and Jim Tomey when I'm coming up, and, you know, Robbie Alomar, who was great to me.
Yeah.
He was very tremendous player and a tremendous friend to me. And you see myself, my role kind of evolve over the years into something like that. You know, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's one of those things, like the Yankees got Nick Swisher last year, and I had no idea Nick Swisher was like this. And he comes in, he's like, yeah, he's the life of the clubhouse. He's a jokester. He's been great. Just one of those things that's kind of, there's no website for it. There's no statistics for it. But it seems like every team to succeed needs three or four guys like that.
You do. Because the thing is, though, is that you're playing 162 games a year. You know, you got spring training, and it's a grind. It's a grind. And I think that regardless of how good you are, it gets monotonous and you get tense when the moments get tense. To have guys that kind of break the moments, and you need that. And
right.
I think that it's just like people talk about, you know, team chemistry and stuff like that. And you got to have that kind of outgoing guy that's just very unselfish. And Nick Swisher, you know, is as unselfish as they get. And for him to, you know, come in that clubhouse and you got Jeter and Rodriguez and Posada, Revere, Pettit, all these super, superstars, and to have that comfort to be able to be himself, that's invaluable for that ball club.
All right, last question. So your career goes from 1999 to 2008. This is the height of the HGH, steroids, all this stuff. Now baseball is moving back to an era that kind of accentuates the qualities of guys like the qualities you had. You know,
sure.
Speed has become more important. Defense has become more important. Power has become less important. In a weird way, you kind of had bad timing. Like, I wish 1999 Dave Roberts was here in 2009.
Yeah, you know what's funny is that the game has definitely kind of evolved back into, you know, the home runs have started to kind of come down, and the stolen base is becoming a bigger play in baseball. And a lot of these games are close games. You know what? I have no regrets. I love what I did, but it is definitely fun to see, you know, guys trying to manufacture runs and things like that, and not seeing leadoff hitters hit, you know, 25, you know, to 50 home runs like
right.
we saw, you know, 10 years ago. So I think it's getting back to, you know, the way the game was meant to be played.
Yeah, I saw a guy, I was watching SportsCenter last night, a guy in Colorado had 5 stolen bases in the first 4 innings.
Yeah,
just
exactly.
Eating up Chris Young completely. And it's like, this is actually more fun. You know, Jacoby Ellsbury steals home plate on Sunday night against the Yankees. And it's like, this is actually a little more interesting than just watching home runs. I don't know.
No, it really is. And I think one of my favorite World Series of all time is to see the Marlins and the Yankees play and see that David and Goliath story. And what Juan Pierre and Luis Castillo did to that Yankee team was amazing to me.
All right, Dave Roberts, thank you for your time. I really want you to come back during the baseball season. I just feel like my day is better when we cross paths. It's just a happier day for me.
I appreciate it. It's my pleasure.
And thanks for everything you do. And again, I would strongly consider, from an economic standpoint, maybe moving back to New England and opening up a chain of sports bars or something. You might have to at least think about that.
I'm going to talk to my wife and we'll work on it.
All right, thanks, Dave.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.
You laughed, you cried, you turned up the sound repeatedly, and now it's all over. This concludes another installment of the BS Report. And with all the talk about sports, Bill Simmons neglected to mention this important just-breaking news.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin.
The $5 foot-long anthem rolls on with Subway Everyday Value. So many of your Subway favorites are $5 foot-longs, like that Tastetacular Spicy Italian $5 foot-long and the piled ridiculously high BLT $5 foot-long, both made to your order on the freshly baked bread of your choice.